with you. Let us pray, beginning with some verses in a prayer known as Psalm 139. O Lord, where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light around me become night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you. Gracious, ever-present, always-present God, you are with us even when we do not ask. But enlighten us now as we study the scriptures, that in your constant presence we may come to know you and thus to serve you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Well, I'm surprised, given the weather, you're not all headed to Heart Lake or someplace.
Trails are already full.
Probably. This morning and yesterday morning remind me of the first time I was ever up here, exactly 20 years ago this month. And there used to be two settings of every meal. We would stand outside and wait for the bell to ring so that we could go in and sit down for a setting, and we were standing outside waiting for breakfast one morning, on a morning exactly like this, and a fellow named Rick Dunning, who used to always be the curator up at the museum, was standing in line with us, and he looked around and he said, "Ah, just another crummy day in the Cascades." Well, I guess if you've been here long enough. Well, my name is Fred Niedner, and I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, doing a series on Ezekiel, the source of the theme verse for this summer. The verse itself comes from Ezekiel 47, about the river that flows, and where it flows, life abounds, and as we'll eventually see, that river flows from a very extraordinary kind of temple and gives life to the world. But we're looking at some other things that Ezekiel reinvented for the Israelites in the aftermath of the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586 or 587 BC, the exile that had actually begun a decade earlier, and the total collapse of the symbol system known as the religion of the ancient Israelites. Somebody had to help them start over, and Ezekiel was one of the pivotal figures. What we're going to do today will demonstrate that without Ezekiel, or at least I will submit to you, that without Ezekiel, nobody would have ever written Psalm 139, that thing I read about the omnipresence of God. Because there was no such idea in the earliest times of Israel. And so that's our theme today. Our question is, where is God? And how do teachings develop among the ancient Israelites that answer that question? Where is God? So the day's alleged hilarity is a little bit unusual. I thought about bringing my laptop down here because I'm pretty sure on my laptop I have a video copy of this. You folks, unlike my current generation of students, actually, or at least some of you, know who Guido Sarducci is. Right? Guido Sarducci, Father Guido Sarducci, the gossip columnist for the Vatican newspaper. Who was a frequent character on the old Saturday Night Live in its earliest days. He's actually a comedian named Don Novello, who invented the character Guido Sarducci. And Guido Sarducci used to tour with Gilda Radner, the comedian who was also on Saturday Night Live, who would do theater performances of skits that she had written and would get others to participate in. And between skits, Guido Sarducci would come out and philosophize. And I once heard him do this live, and now if you want to find this on YouTube, it's very easy to find. There's a recording of it. But it's very precious to me, and I repeat this often to my students, because it's a theory of general education in higher education. Guido Sarducci, I mean, he had a lot of businesses going. He had a business called Pope for a Day. And he became his own Pope of the People's Church. And he sold vestments. So you could apply to be Pope for a day, and he would sell you the vestments. Everybody in the world could be Pope for one day, eventually. He took turns. But here was one of his enterprises. He asked the question, why go to a university or a college for 4 years and spend tens of thousands of dollars, or nowadays, if he was to do this today, it would be $100,000, in order to learn what 5 years later will be about 5 minutes worth of stuff that you can actually remember having learned in college. I mean, just think about it. If you tried to repeat all the stuff you learned in college, how long could you go on? So he says, why spend all that money and do that? Come to my 5-minute university. And I will teach you just the things that you will remember 5 years after college. So he said, we have a foreign language requirement. That's necessary in this day and age. If you take Spanish, for example, we will teach you one thing. ¿Cómo está? Muy bien. How are you? I am fine. Which is about all anybody remembers. 5 years after taking 2 semesters of Spanish for a general education. Everybody needs work, so everybody will study business. You'll learn one thing. Buy something, sell it for more. And it helps then to know economics. So you need to know one thing, supply and demand. Because he's a theologian, a priest, there's a theology requirement at his university. And the whole course is to ask one question, where is God? And the answer is, God is everywhere. Why? Because he likes you. Which, Guido says, is a combination of Roman Catholic and Disney theology. Which is just kind of perfect for the modern age. And then, you know, his version is, what he then says, he has a little spring break in there, you know. You take 20 seconds, drink a glass of orange juice, have a sun lamp for a moment. And then when you're all finished, he has a little commencement ceremony, and then he said he's thinking about establishing a law school next door to the 5-minute university. You got an extra minute? You know, I tell my students, don't tell your parents that, but there's a grain of truth. Or don't tell who's ever helping you pay for this. You know, anyway, the reason I repeated all that is for that question, where is God? In the earliest days of Israel, they would not have said, God is everywhere. They would have said, and they would have thought like everyone else did in those earlier centuries. He was deceased by the time I met my wife, but on his tombstone up in the next town from us, it says, everybody's got to be someplace. I kind of wish I'd have known him. that applied also to deities back in the days of henotheism. A god was in charge of a territory. A god reigned over a territory the way a king reigned over a territory. You have your gods over there in Philistia. Our god reigns here among the Israelites. Babylonian gods rule over there in Mesopotamia, etc. You can see this functionally at work in some really old texts like that thing I referred to the other day when talking about the various parts of the Deuteronomistic history, the thing that is known as the Ark Narrative. So if you've got your Bibles, we're going to take a running start on Ezekiel today. And would you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 4 if you want to follow along. In 1 Samuel chapter 4, the Israelites, still at the end of the time of the judges, before they had kings, they were doing battle with the Philistines, as they sort of always were. Philistines used to womp up on them all the time because the Philistines were already slightly into the Iron Age. The Israelites were still in the Bronze Age. They weren't a seafaring people and hadn't learned metallurgy well enough yet to have hardened chariot axles and things like that. So the Philistines were a formidable foe. And the Philistines mustered for war against Israel, and Israel went out to battle against them, encamped at Ebenezer, the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle was joined, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the troops came to the camp, the elders said, "Why has the Lord put us to the rout today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, so that he may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. You know what the cherubim are? The cherubim were these... I also could have brought my laptop today because I'm pretty sure on there I've got some photos of surviving cherubim figures from the ancient world that have been stolen from places like Babylon and Egypt and brought to the United States, to places like the Oriental Institute in Chicago. There are various sorts of them depending upon whether they came from Egypt or Babylon or Israel, but a cherub is not a fat little Anglo-Saxon baby that floats above a nativity scene with wings, but a cherub is mostly a bull figure, or sometimes a lion figure, with sometimes a human head. The Babylonian ones had king-type faces with very manicured beards. And they had wings. And so it was most often the body of a bull or a lion and wings and a human face, although not always a human face. And according to the Pentateuch, the Ark of the Covenant that they were instructed to build out of precious metals and fill up with relics like the tablets and some samples of manna and a few things like that. On top of the Ark of the Covenant, facing out in each direction, was a cherub on one end and a cherub on the other end, made of gold. And this was the throne of Yahweh. This is where Yahweh sat. And if you want special help in a battle, you haul Yahweh's throne out to the battle, and Yahweh will scare the bejeebers out of your enemy, and you will win. Because God can't come to the battle unless you bring him. Okay? Now, the whole ancient world was full of cherub figures. Cherubim is plural for cherub. And as I said, we still have some of these things. They've set them up to guard temples. The ones at the Oriental Institute are 15 feet high, 30 feet long. They're very frightening looking things. And a cherub would be posted on each side of the door of an ancient palace or temple, symbolizing the guardianship of the gods of that town, who would be whom you should fear if you want to come into this town. So the Ark of the Covenant has two of these things on it, on which is enthroned the Lord of Hosts. Everybody's got to be someplace, and that's where Yahweh sits. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant. When the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded, and when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting mean in the camp of the Hebrews?" And when they learned the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, they were frightened. For they said, "Oh, gods have come into the camp! Woe is us! Nothing like this ever happened before! Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods that struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage, be men, O Philistines. Don't become slaves of the Hebrews. Be men, fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And they fled, everyone to his home. And there was a great slaughter. 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell, and the Ark of God was captured. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. A man of Benjamin ran back to Shiloh with the news, and the news sends Eli falling backwards to break his neck and die. His pregnant daughter-in-law, wife of one of the dead sons, Phinehas, went into labor. Upon hearing the news, and died giving birth to a child whom she named Ichabod, which means the glory has gone. And so this is a very fateful moment for the people of Israel. They not only lost the battle, they lost the ark. Where is Yahweh? Captured. Sort of like a game of chess. They have captured the god. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, verse 5, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. That's a Philistine city, and the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon. That's their god. The next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord, probably in worship position. So they set Dagon back up. I mean, this will never do. But when they rose early the next morning, Dagon was fallen back on the ground before the Lord. Not only that, his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. And please notice, it doesn't say the statue of Dagon. This is two gods trying to live in one temple. And it's not working. And Dagon is having the worst of it. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon don't step on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. The hand of Yahweh was heavy upon the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and struck them with tumors all through the territory, not just Ashdod. And when the inhabitants saw how things were, they said, "We got to get rid of this thing. The Ark of God must not remain with us. His hand is heavy upon us." I'm not going to go through the whole rest of the thing. They take counsel with other cities nearby, and they decide that what they're going to do is they're going to send the thing off loaded with bribes, so that it'll go back and stay among whoever it was it used to be with. And so they fill up the thing with gold and they tie it to a pair of cows. They whack the cows in the hindquarters and the cows go lurching off toward Israelite territory with the ark bouncing along behind it, and full of gold and all kinds of other stuff that the Philistines sent. And the thing finally arrives at a place called Beth Shemesh in chapter 6, verses 12 and following. The cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right nor to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border to make sure they kept going. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest, and they saw this thing coming. And they go, holy cow, look at that. Here comes the ark. And so they burned offerings, and they have a big old festival, and they check out these gold tumors that the Philistines have stuck in there. And there was a little bit of dissension among the people, and then lo and behold, when a certain group came and greeted them, verse 19 and following, the ark of the Lord lashed out and killed 70 people at the celebration. And the people of Beth Shemesh said, well, who's able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? To whom shall he go, so we may be rid of him? So they sent messengers to Kiriath to Aram, saying, the Philistines sent the ark back. How would you like to have it?
They didn't tell them about the 70 dead people.
You know, this is, you know, pawning off this problem. So for 20 years, the ark just rested, sort of exiled in this place called Kiriath to Aram. And there it stays. And then you get the whole story of Samuel appointing a king and everything, and there's no more attention to the ark at all until you get to 2 Samuel 6, when King David is trying to consolidate power and all manner of political and religious symbols, so that he can do better at uniting the people of Israel than his predecessor Saul had done. And so in 2 Samuel 6, we find that David is going to take a stab at bringing the ark to Jerusalem. David gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. They set out to bring from there, from Baal of Judah, to bring from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. They carried the ark of God on a new cart, brought it out of the house of Abinadab, where it was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the ark of God, and Ahio went in the front. David and all the house of Israel were dancing before the Lord with all their might, with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, because the oxen shook it and he thought it was going to fall off the cart. So all he did was want to stop it from falling, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and it struck him there because he reached out his hand, and he died besides the ark. So that'll teach you to touch the ark. Angry because the Lord had burst forth with an outburst upon Uzzah, David called the place Perez Uzzah, which it is to this day, and he was afraid to bring it any further. How can the ark of the Lord come into my care? So the point of the story is, God is enthroned on the cherubim of the Ark of the Covenant. But, and you may think that you can haul God around and get God to do your bidding just because you haul him out to your battle, or just because you want to, as David wants to do, centralize the religious symbols of the people, but you can't just haul God around and make God your puppet. If God wants to, God can do holy war all by God's self, like God did against Dagon and the Philistines. So you can't turn God into your a slave, like your dog, to whom you can just say, "Sikkim, Yahweh." No, Yahweh goes where Yahweh wants. And Yahweh will battle whomever Yahweh wants to battle. And that's the lesson that has been consistently, or the point that's been consistently made in this story. So David wants the Ark of the Covenant in Jerusalem. What we're going to see is the Ark won't be in Jerusalem unless it wants to be. That's the point of this story. So finally David gets up his nerve again, because the thing hasn't caused any trouble again in a while. So David thinks, "I'll try again." And he offers some sacrifices and dresses up in a special way. And he has the Ark of the Lord brought again into the city with the sound of shouting and trumpets. Verse 16, "The Ark of the Lord came into the city of David. And Michael, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window." This is a whole other story that would be fun to do. You know the story of how he got Michael? Saul, his predecessor, tried to get David killed by betting him he couldn't bring home 100 foreskins of the Philistines, because the Philistines don't donate them, and they figured he'd probably get killed trying to collect them. David says, "Sure, it's a bet," and he brings 200. And so Saul has to give David his daughter, and this is Michal, the wife that David won in a bet. She's looking out the window, seeing the king leaping and dancing half naked before the girls of the city, and she despised him in her heart. They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it, and they offered offerings and distributed all kinds of goodies for the celebration. And the thing didn't kill anybody. It must be okay to have brought it here. So now the Ark is in Jerusalem, the central religious symbol of at least many of the people of Israel. And this is a coup for David to actually have got this thing away from the northerners and from Shiloh, where it really belongs. And now it's in Jerusalem, his new capital city, which he conquered and took from the Jebusites. And of course, as we know, he was not allowed to build a temple there for the thing. That would fall to his son Solomon. So the next stage in the picture of where is Yahweh comes in 1 Kings chapter 6 to 9. Solomon builds the temple, and we'll have reason to return a little bit to some of this when we look at Ezekiel's vision of the temple that he has in the time of the exile. All of this stuff is related ultimately, but we're doing it in separate parts. In chapter 6, we read some of the dimensions and so forth. In chapter 6, verse 19, you see that the innermost sanctuary Solomon had prepared for housing the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. And the interior of the sanctuary was 20 cubits by 20 cubits by 20 cubits. It was a perfect cube, 20 cubits in dimension, and overlaid with pure gold. In the innermost sanctuary, verse 23, he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. It's a big cubit. I mean, a big cherubim. This is one of those Babylonian-sized cherubim. The measurement from one wingtip to the other was 10 cubits. And there are two of these. And he put the cherubim in the innermost part of the house. The wings of the cherubim were spread out so that a wing of one was touching one wall and a wing of the other cherub was touching the other wall. Their other wings toward the center of the house were touching wing to wing, and he overlaid these with gold. So two absolutely enormous cherubim, underneath which now will be placed the Ark of the Covenant, on which there are two smaller cherubim, and that is the throne of Yahweh of hosts. And then Solomon will eventually dedicate this temple, and in the course of this, we will hear the promise that I referred to. You can see in chapter 8 the bringing of the ark. Verse 3, the elders of the people came and carried the ark. They brought up the ark of the Lord, the tent of meeting, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent, and the priests and the Levites brought them up, and King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel were there for this, and they installed the Ark of the Covenant in that inner sanctuary in the most holy place underneath the wings of the cherubim. And then in the course of the dedication of this temple, Yahweh makes that promise that I referred to either yesterday or the day before, in which God says, I will make my name dwell there forever. Chapter 9, verse 3 and following. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. Now, part of this chapter later on, most people think this was written later after it happened and came true. There is a threat that if you ever disobey God in a certain way, you will lose this temple. But the original promise is that God will make his name dwell there forever and his eyes and heart be there for all time. So, where is God? God is in the Jerusalem temple, enthroned on the cherubim. And eventually, as we saw, kings like Hezekiah and especially Josiah saw to it that you couldn't worship God except there at Jerusalem. Then we have this development that I alluded to briefly already earlier in the week in 1 Kings chapters 11 and following. You get the story of how Solomon abused his power and amassed wealth, collected 1,000 wives, actually 700 wives and 300 concubines. And the story is that, among other things, these women turned his heart so that he was no longer faithful as he once had been to Yahweh, and he allowed the worship of other gods in Jerusalem because a lot of these wives were treaty wives, women that he gained by making treaties, and they were required because of that to tolerate those women's worship in Jerusalem. Not only that, Solomon had put about a third of his own people into forced labor. They were sick of it, and so when he died, the northern territories rebelled. They asked him to ease up, but he said, no, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Ease up, forget it. I'm going to make it even harder. They said, we're out of here. They set up their own king in exile named Jeroboam. And then we have Jeroboam setting up a capital up in the northern territory. And then he recognizes he has a problem. And we alluded to this the other day, chapter 12, verse 25 and following. Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and resided there. He went out and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said to himself, now the kingdom may well revert to the house of David. If the people continues to go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, the heart of the people will turn again to their master, King Rehoboam of Judah, and they'll kill me and return to him. So the king took counsel and said, the king took counsel and made two calves of gold. He said to the people, "You've gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." He set one in Bethel and put the other in Dan. And this became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one at Bethel and before the other at Dan. And so for the rest of the story, every king in the northern territory will be condemned for repeating the sin of Jeroboam. That is, allowing people to go worship at Bethel and Dan instead of Jerusalem. Now, I have a question for you. Now, this is sort of another way to get at the question that was asked the other day. If you were here, somebody said, how do we know that this is revisionist history by Southerners who are telling the story? Think about this. If you were a member, maybe some of you have been members of congregations that have split in recent times over some fight or another in the church, and if you were part of a split congregation that lost your sanctuary, and you had to start over somewhere, and the place where your children had been baptized, where you'd had grandma's funeral, and where so many of the sacred memories of your family were, you lost that place, and you got to do something different, just let me ask you, how many of you would think to yourself, well, we've lost our church. I know what let's do. Let's worship cows. I see no hands. Of course not. That's stupid. That's ridiculous. The northerners were the zealous Yahweh worshipers. That was where the people were who came in the Exodus. The southerners were the newbies who were sort of conquered gradually. They're going to suddenly worship cows because they have no access to the Ark of the Covenant? No. Jeroboam put a cherub down in Bethel and a cherub up in Dan, at the far extremes of north and south of his kingdom. And he said, thereby, our whole country is an ark. Our whole country is the place that Yahweh is enthroned. Forget those guys down there who think they got God in a box. We are the true people of God, because that's the real question. Which is the right synod? You got two groups, each believing themselves the true heirs of the tradition of the God who brought us out of Egypt. And the Ark of the Covenant was the symbol of that time. And so all Jeroboam could do was to reinvent an ark. So that's what I believe he was doing. And the Southerners, who wrote the history much later, said, yeah, those Northerners, they worship cows. They're just stupid. Reinvention of religious traditions and symbols is a long, long, and necessary practice. Ezekiel was not the first reinventor. Jeroboam and his generation had done something very similar. Well, of course, the temple that Solomon built is lost in 586 at the time of the Babylonians' destruction. And I don't know exactly how to account for this, and there's not a lot written about it, but when you read the description in 2 Kings 24 and following about how the Babylonians destroyed everything and in various waves looted the city of Jerusalem and the temple in particular, there are whole lists of the things that they stole and carried away. But nowhere in any of the lists, either in 2 Kings or in the other account, the much, much later account in Chronicles, in neither account is the ark even mentioned. So for some reason, either they didn't know, or they couldn't bear to talk about, or something, the ark just vanished. And it's never again mentioned.
So we can have movies today.
Yes. Well, that's right. It was not found until Indiana Jones found it, and I've actually seen it in the movie. It's sitting in a warehouse in Nazi territory. With a tag on it. So, the ark is gone. Where is God? Well, if everybody has to be someplace, and the temple is destroyed, the city of Jerusalem is in ruins, one obvious answer is Yahweh went down with the city. And you might as well worship Marduk. Go with a winner God. Yahweh either wanted to help you and couldn't, or could have helped you and didn't. And in any case, the ark is gone. Yahweh's throne has vanished. Where is Yahweh? We haven't a clue. And so you get some very poignant exilic poems, like Psalm 137. How are you even supposed to sing songs of the Lord in this foreign place? Like, what direction do you face? May my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I ever forget those songs, but I can never sing them again, says the song. Well, Ezekiel is a prophet who has a response to this problem. And now is the time to turn finally to Ezekiel chapter 1. To that bizarre vision that Ezekiel has at the very beginning of So in the 30th year of the fourth month, the heavens were opened. And verse 4, I looked, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with brightness around it, fire flashing forth continually, and in the middle of the fire something like gleaming amber, and in the middle of that something like four living creatures. This was their appearance. They were of human form. Each had four faces. Each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of a calf's foot. So they have human forms, but they have calf's feet. So a little bit different ratio than the Babylonian cherubs, or the ones that were on the Ark of the Covenant. You got less calf, more human. And then four faces. We'll eventually see more about the faces. Under the wings, on their four sides, they had human hands. And the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each of them moved straight ahead and without turning as they moved. So they're standing in formation. These are wings, not hands. And they stand in a rectangle, with their wings touching, so that, you know, each of them is a corner figure. And they're touching with their wings. And they have four faces. One is the face of a human being. One is the face of a lion. Another an ox. And the fourth an eagle. So, kind of a four-sided head with a face on each of the four sides. Their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the other. And just like all of the other parts of Ezekiel, this is very redundant. He'll say the same thing over and over and over. And in the middle of the living creatures, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. The fire was bright. The lightning issued from the fire. The living creatures darted to and fro like a flash of lightning. And then I looked and I saw a wheel on the earth besides each living creature, one apiece. And then it describes the wheels. The wheels are very elaborate. The wheels have eyes around the rims. And the wheels, there's a wheel within a wheel. And so you get this whirring set of wheels that are besides each of these things. And wherever the spirit would go, the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. Verse 20. And then verse 22. Over the heads of the living creatures, there was something like a dome. Our word for firmament is the same word as in the creation story of what God put over the earth to keep the water from coming down all at once. It was spread out above their heads. Under the dome, their wings were stretched out straight, and each of the creatures had two wings covering its body, and when they moved, I heard the sound of their wings like the sound of mighty waters, the thunder of the Almighty, and the sound of tumult like the sound of an army. When they stopped, they let down their wings, and a voice from the dome over their heads when they stopped. Above the dome, there was something like a throne, in appearance like sapphire, and seated above the likeness of a throne was something that seemed like a human form. Upward from what appeared like the loins, I saw something like gleaming amber, something that looked like fire and enclosed all around, and downward from what looked like the loins, I saw something that looked like fire, and there was splendor all around, like the bow in a cloud on a rainy day. Such was the appearance of the splendor all around. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face and I heard the voice of someone speaking. Okay, you see what this is? This is four newfangled cherubim with their wings and their calves' feet wheeled and able to fly, go in any direction, and above them a platform, and on top of the platform a throne, and on the throne, in description of all these precious metals and gems and everything else, those kind of colors. Above that you have the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. You notice how many layers of distance that is? It doesn't say, and above that sat Yahweh. Because Ezekiel doesn't believe you can ever lay eyes on Yahweh. But you can see something that is the appearance of the likeness of the glory. Enough to make you fall on your face. All right. My name for this is a Yahweh mobile. This is an Ark of the Covenant that is self-powered. It doesn't need Hophni and Phinehas or anybody like that to haul it around. This thing can mount up and go where it wants, thanks to this ability to, you know, just rise up, go down this way, that way, and do it in such perfect coordination. Now here's the question. If Yahweh were going to go somewhere on Yahweh's Yahweh-mobile, where would Yahweh go? Chapter 10. Ezekiel's having visions shown to him by this linen-clad figure. And in chapter 10, then I looked, and above the dome there was over the heads of the cherubim. There appeared above them something like sapphire, in form resembling a throne. He said to the man clothed in linen, "Go within the wheelwork underneath the cherubim, fill your hands with burning coals among the cherubim, and scatter them over the city." He went in as I looked on. Now the cherubim were standing on the south side of the house when the man went in, and a cloud filled the inner court. This is the Jerusalem temple. He's having a vision of this thing residing at the Jerusalem temple. Then the glory of the Lord rose up from the cherub to the threshold of the house, and the house was filled with cloud, and the cloud was full of the brightness of the glory of the Lord, and the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks. And then we have a whole business about what we're going to do with these coals, symbolizing spreading them over the city. And then he sees more of the vision of the vehicle again, the four wheels beside the cherubim and so forth. And another description of how the thing moves and whatnot. And then at verse 15, the cherubim rose up. These were the living creatures that I saw by the river Kibar when he had his vision back in chapter 1. When the cherubim moved, the wheels moved beside them, and when the cherubim lifted up their wings to rise up from the earth, the wheels at their side did not veer. When they stopped, the others stopped. When they rose up, the others rose up, for the spirit of the living creatures was in them. And the glory of the Lord went out from the threshold of the house and stopped above the cherubim. The cherubim lifted up their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight as they went out with the wheels beside them. They stopped at the entrance of the east gate of the house of the Lord, and the glory of the Lord of God of Israel was above them. And these were the living creatures that I saw underneath the God of Israel by the river Kibor and so forth. And then it's just more redundant description. Where is Yahweh? On that Yahweh mobile, last seen leaving the east gate of the temple, headed east. And where's east? Excuse me. Babylon. When you headed east, that's where you ended up. At least if you were going to go as the ark flies. This is how Ezekiel could teach his people that Yahweh was not trapped in the rubble of the Jerusalem temple, but Yahweh could come into exile with them. Yahweh can go anywhere Yahweh wants. Yahweh did not perish in the rubble, but has come into exile with us, because Yahweh can go anywhere. Now, this isn't exactly a doctrine of omnipresence. We're not quite that far yet. But this is a step in the direction of a new theology, because the old theology that said everybody's got to be someplace didn't work. That theology was no longer helpful. They couldn't keep on if that were the truth. So Ezekiel made a new theology. Yahweh can come with us. We are not as abandoned as we think.
Are we still making new theology?
Are we still making new theology? Absolutely. We do it all the time. Theology is made on earth, not in heaven. By people who understand God as well as dung beetles understand us. It will remain for the other prophet of the exile to go the rest of the way. And we have a couple minutes. We can. I'll just show you this quickly, and then we have a few minutes to discuss, although I know I'm breaking the desired ratio. I'm doing 55 parts of talking and 5 parts of discussion. But Isaiah chapter 40 comes from near the end of exile, addressed to the people whom Cyrus of Persia is about to release after his having conquered Babylon. And all through this book, and in these early poems, there is the teaching that there are no other gods except Yahweh. So this is the first full-blown monotheism of the Hebrew Scriptures. And also, This is the poet who answers the question, where is God in this way? In verses 12 and following, there's this whole poem about how can anybody ever measure the creation, which for God is like a tiny little plaything almost. And verses 21 and following is where I'd like you to look if you're reading a Bible. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to live in, who brings princes to naught and makes rulers of the earth as nothing. In other words, the blue thing is Yahweh's tabernacle. The word for tent here is the word for tabernacle. The whole earth is Yahweh's tent. There is no place you can go on the platform except you're in Yahweh's tent. And Yahweh is the only God. And Yahweh sits above and looks down, and we are like grasshoppers. In fact, the nations are like dust. But we're all, everyone, in Yahweh's tent. There is nobody who isn't in Yahweh's tent. You can never be lost to God. That's this prophet's teaching. Now we're more or less at omnipresence, which is a long way from everybody's got to be someplace and Yahweh is enthroned on the ark.
Even the Missouri Senate.
Pardon me?
Even the Missouri Senate.
Oh, God is in St. Louis. I'm just kidding. So there's some reinvention that had to happen. The old theology simply collapsed. It didn't work. The theology of God's presence at the Jerusalem temple proved finally to be a failed theology. And they had to retool and rethink or else give up. And this happens from time to time in human history when there's a crisis that brings down and makes your theology into quaint nonsense. And, you know, Ezekiel was one of the helpers. Any other questions? We can take a minute. You all heard the bell, but quickly.
It's kind of like science in a way. That they keep discovering things they didn't know before. And so we're still trying to approach it that way, where we find something that changes, and so we try to tweak it.
Well, obviously, experience has an enormous part in doing theology. I mean, theology and religion are not the same thing, but they are close, and most of you have probably heard, because it's all over the place these days, that the word religion comes from the same root as the word for ligament. You know, your ligaments are what holds your body together so that you don't just fly off in pieces. Religion is what holds your worldview together. It's what allows you to understand the world as something whole and not just a chaotic smattering of stuff and events. Religion is what you use to give yourself a comprehensive picture of reality that's actually livable. And every so often, your way of holding it all together doesn't work because you have an experience that you cannot account for. You have an experience that means your system hadn't thought of something. And so when you have an experience that breaks and you cannot finally account for it, you have to retool. It's just the way human beings are. This is what we have to do. We cannot live with chaos. We have to build systems that allow us to understand the universe. And whether you're a religious person or not, you have a theology in the sense that you have a comprehensive vision of what the world is, and to the extent that it makes sense, you can say how. And that's what an overall theology is. And these things grow and change. It's changed many times since then. I mean, we didn't really want to change it when Galileo and Copernicus came on, but we finally didn't have a choice. And the Pope just let them in a few years ago. I said, well, I guess they were right. It's not a platform. Okay, we're out of time. See you tomorrow.